from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We've heard a lot about politicians moving into big lobbying money in recent years, but keep an eye on the rest of the family, sons and daughters and more of the politically powerful, ending up remarkably well-placed in industries where mom and dad may have influence. Is this the new American way? This hour On Point, the power elite and nepotism in America. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you seen it? Is this how it's always worked? Or is concentrating wealth breeding concentrating advantage? Nepotism. Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in the hour, we will look at the new format of the SAT. But first, joining me from Washington is Claire Malone, editor and writer at the American Prospect. Her new story in the Daily Beast is headlined, Get Elected, Get Your Kids Rich, Washington is Spoiled Rotten. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Claire Malone, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Okay. Dynasties in families are nothing new. Barbara Bush is talking about it. Here she was on C-SPAN. This was just January, saying politics should be open to all, not just political families.
If we can't find more than two or three families to run for high office, that's silly, because there are great governors and great eligible people to run. And I think that the Kennedys, Clintons, Bushes, they're just more families than that.
Well, we'll see how that works out with Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush. But you're pointing beyond politics to this intersection of political families and business. And what are you finding there, Claire?
Right. Well, I think that what we're finding is there's actually a lot of politicians' kids who maybe aren't going into the family business of public office, but they're really keying into opportunities that their name and connections can bring them in the private sector. And, you know, we've got a lot of organizations that are sort of keeping an eye on people in government office. And so we know all the Kennedys and the Bushes and, you know, we know everyone who's running for office in Boston who has a Kennedy last name. But maybe we're not looking at the people who are making money in consulting or private equity. And, you know, these are spheres of power and money where who you know matters a lot. And so there are a lot of children of particularly people in Congress who are really making a nice living for themselves.
I want to run through it. I mean, there's a lot of detail here. Some of it reads like an Old Testament family tree, as you say, so-and-so related to so-and-so. We'll look at that. But give us a sense. I mean, should our hair be on fire here or not? Hasn't there always been a lot of this? I mean, it may not line up with our merit, our egalitarian pretensions, as you say, really our desire to be merit-based. But is there something new going on here, Claire?
Well, I don't think that nepotism is anything new. So I think, you know, let's get that out of the way right now. I do think, and you know, I talked to a few people who said that, you know, maybe because of the increasing power and wealth that's being concentrated in Washington, you know, there are a lot of sort of private contracting firms. There's a lot of people who are pouring into these particular zip codes, and they're all sort of intermarrying, and maybe there are big power centers being created. But nepotism is sort of tale as old as time. And I think, you know, you just mentioned that the lobbyists are sort of probably the biggest. Block of people that are really playing into their family name, and that's existed for, you know, decades and centuries.
But you lay out a lot, and it's really worth keeping our eye on here. I want to run through some of this if we can.
Sure.
Tell us the story of Joe Manchin, West Virginia Senator, Democrat. His daughter Heather. Take it back to I guess all the way back to when she got started in her career and where she's ended up, and the sort of story around that.
Sure. Heather Brush, who is the daughter of Joe Manchin, who is the former governor of West Virginia and is now their senator. Heather is now the CEO of Mylan Inc., which is a pharmaceuticals company. But she got her start. Her father was at a WVU basketball game, and he ran into the CEO at the time, or the founder of this pharmaceutical company. And he said, hey, my daughter, you know, she was probably right out of college. My daughter needs a job.
And this was, Mylan Pushkar?
Yes, guy. Mylan mm-hmm. Pushkar. Mm-hmm. And so he said, sure. And she, you know, and I want to say right here, she did start at the bottom. And so, you know, the accounts are that she started working, you know, putting labels on bottles or checking quality control. And over the course of 15
enough.
or right? 15 or 20 years, sort of worked your way, stopping at the one point at the Department of Government Relations, Director of Government Relations for the company, which is essentially sort of, you know, playing on connections and who you know in Washington. But the sort of the trouble came in 2008 when she was CEO of the company. She is now CEO of the company.
Which She's an MBA or not?
Well, this is the problem. In 2008, a Pittsburgh Post-Gazette investigation found that she hadn't actually completed the course requirements for her MBA, and school administrations at West Virginia, school administrators at West Virginia had sort of, you know, essentially falsified some records for her.
So she claimed that they gave it to her, but it wasn't really completed.
Correct. And the school eventually did an investigation, revoked her MBA. She is still CEO of the company. But, you know, this is sort of an instance of if she had been any other student, if her father had not been, you know, if she had not come from a prominent family, would the same thing have happened?
And on her way up the ladder at this company, was the company doing business with the state of West Virginia?
Yes. I mean, the company has a couple of factories in West Virginia. So, you know, they're a big employer in the state. And so it was an important relationship, you know, state governments have with companies that are doing work. So Mylan Pharmaceuticals got a lot of tax breaks, you know, corporate tax breaks. So, yeah, this is sort of an instance of connections at play, both in government and business, and sort of the family ties that
she gets the job, ends up being CEO. They do a lot of business with the state along the way, where her dad is governor, moving toward eventually being senator. Mm-hmm. You get this whole murkiness around her pedigree. Who knows? I mean, the fact that the Pushkar donated $20 million and had the football field named after him at WVU just might have had something to do with all that you suggest.
Right, right. You know, there's a lot of money floating around, and you know, I think it's important to point out that, you know, maybe these aren't necessarily tit for tat explicit agreements, but names matter in places and money matters and, you know, money talks to a certain extent. So, yeah.
I can just hear people trying to decide whether this is new enough and big enough that it's a big deal or whether this is, as you say, tale as old as time. Give us some more of these stories. What else have you found in your report?
Sure. Well, there are a lot of examples. Adam Wyden, who is the son of a senator, is one example. He started a hedge fund right out of college after interning in college for a $19 billion hedge fund.
This is Ron Wyden's son, Oregon Democrat.
Yes, run by one of his father's supporters. And I believe this came out in a 2011 Bloomberg article. And someone at the company was quoted as saying, well, you know, there aren't that many kids just out of college who can start a hedge fund, and you can bet your bottom dollar that, you know, he was leveraging connections that he made working in that very rarefied space of that $19 billion hedge
fund. But what's the outrage here? He interned at a hedge fund. People intern all over the place, though I guess.
Sure.
So what do you see? What's the math on that?
Well, you're right. People on all levels of society and, you know, of all spectrums of wealth intern places. But it's sort of what advantages can you get if you know the right people? And a lot of times connections turn into money and profits because people in certain spheres know each other and want to work together. So I think it's fair to say that Adam Wyden started with a very big leg up.
Your suggestion is also that these companies, when they hire this way, they're keeping an eye on the father or mother, the sort of political power behind the child.
Sure. Yeah. And I think that definitely comes in. You know, I talked to a bunch of people who sort of monitor ethics and politics in Washington. And I think especially with a lot of lobbying firms and maybe with, you know, other corporations, they want to hire the sons and daughters of people who are important in Washington, because not necessarily that they're going to say, hey, kid, why don't you get your dad to pass this bill? But it's very easy to have the son or daughter of someone in the room when you're talking about a thing that's important for the company. And what can we do to make it pass through this committee? You know, Joe, what are your thoughts? And maybe Joe's dad runs, you know, the House Appropriations Committee.
Volume matters here. Give us more stories. What?
There's the story of Shaka Fata Jr., who is the son of a Philadelphia area congressman, who's under federal investigation for essentially to figure out whether or not he used his influence to gain contracts. He runs a management consulting firm, and in 2010, he was paid about $450,000 by a for-profit education firm that runs schools in Philadelphia. And it turned out his father The previous year had asked for a $375,000 earmark for these same schools. Now, it didn't go through, but the FBI thought that, you know, enough of his business dealings were suspect that there's been an ongoing investigation into whether or not he sort of, you know, implicitly said, I can make things happen for you. You know, and both the Fatahs deny any wrongdoing. And I think that sort of it gets to the point of a lot of these things aren't explicit. They're sort of, you know, they're very slippery to sort of define. There's a thin red line. But, you know, that's a lot of money that we're talking about. And I think it's hard not to say, were these contracts given based on the merit of his work? Or were they given based on the fact that, well, you know, he might have some influence?
And then, of course, there's all the sort of telegenic kids, you call them. Chris Cuomo and Abby Huntsman and Maria Shriver and Meghan McCain and Jenna Bush and Chelsea Clinton for a while there. And then in the lobbying world, what you call the Old Testament family tree, Andy Blunt, son of Senator Roy Blunt, brother of former Governor Matt Blunt, Andy Coates, son of Senator Dan Coats, Scott Hatch, son of Senator Orrin Hatch, Dave Roberts, son of Senator Pat Roberts, Central Brownfields, and right on. Are people saying, settle down, Claire, this is just the way it is? Or are people saying you're on to something, Claire?
I think they're saying both. but it's been the way it is, but maybe it's getting worse.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the power elite and nepotism in America, political families getting rich, lots of connections at play, maybe the infrastructure of some portion of our inequality. Claire Malone writes about it for the Daily Beast. Her piece is Get Elected, Get Your Kids Rich, Washington is Spoiled Rotten. You can read the whole list. The Old Testament tree of names, she said, says, of business figures and others, media and beyond, linked right into the political power elite in this country. Link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Alex Perrine writes about your piece in Salon, Claire, and says, we scoff when new Kennedys and new Bushes, might add Clintons, show up uninvited in various elections, but at least the children of politicians who run for office have to convince lots of people to give them a job, Alex writes. For those who choose business, one phone call is usually enough to get the gig. You know, online, Claire, lots of people are talking about the stories that have come out recently of American banks hiring the quote-unquote princeling children of Chinese Communist Party muckety-mucks.
Right.
And the scandal over this, even charges flying around, J.P. Morgan Chase and others. Are these comparable or are these different deals?
Well, that's actually sort of what sparked the idea for the piece, which is this J.P. Morgan Chase had what they called a sons and daughters program.
In China.
In China, right, which they basically had a different hiring track for the sons and daughters of powerful Communist Party leaders. And now they're under, you know, they're under investigation under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act.
By the Department of Justice here in this country.
Right, by the Department of Justice. Yes, it's very serious about whether they were giving, you know, if you can't give anything of value for improper advantage is the way the law is worded. But that actually has gotten a lot of people on Wall Street both nervous and up in arms. Arthur Levitt, who's a former head of the SEC under Clinton, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal and said, you know, this is hypocritical. He pointed out that his father was a New York State comptroller. He probably got certain advantages on his way to his job at the SEC, and that these are practices that are perfectly legal and done in the U.S. just as well. Someone who works at Goldman Sachs might very well want to give an internship to his golfing buddy's son because he knows the kid is smart and he knows his father and he sort of trusts the name. And he said, you know, if we're prosecuting these people for what they're doing in China, well, what are we to make of what we're doing at home? And that sort of led me to look into is nepotism practiced that same way?
And you can look right on down. Give us just a couple more quick stories. You've got a Daschle name here, an Enzi name here. What are those?
Yeah, Nathan Daschle now works for Clear Channel Media as part of their government relations department.
Of course, Tom Daschle, big Democrat, former senator, majority leader there. Mm-hmm.
Right. Brad Enzi is an interesting example. His father is Mike Enzi, the senator from Wyoming. Brad Enzi works in an energy company in Wyoming that has been building what's the Two Elk Power Plant, which is a clean coal project. And back in I'm not actually sure of the year right now off the top of my head, but the company that Brad Enzi works for received $10 million in federal stimulus funds from the Department of Energy that Senator Enzi pushed for to go towards clean coal research. And it turns out that the company never actually drilled the research well that it was supposed to use the funds for. And there's been a subsequent investigation into sort of the accounting practices of the firm. So there's some
and on and on. Claire Malone writes about it for the Daily Beast. She quotes Melanie Sloan, executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, saying, "Members of Congress basically are profit centers for their entire families, i.e., through connections." Claire, stand by. I want to invite Catherine Newman into our conversation. She joins us from the Radio Foundation in New York, dean of the Zanville Krieger School of Arts and Sciences, Johns Hopkins University, has looked a lot at mobility in this country, lack of mobility in this country. Catherine Newman, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here again.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So we hear these stories and we're trying to figure out, are we in some kind of different age now? Is this the way it's always been when wealth gets concentrated, as we know it has in recent decades in this country? And does it then concentrate political power and lead inevitably to nepotism? I don't know, even beyond some kind of new aristocracy. Claire quotes the son of Saul Bellow. This is Adam Bellow, who's actually written favorably about nepotism. But he says, you see the articles that come out occasionally that talk about who's married to who in Washington. It's starting to look like the Renaissance papacy, Bellow says, around here. What do you think, Catherine?
I think that nepotism is a special case of what we in the sociological trade think of as network influence. And it's everywhere. It's well beyond politics. And I think all of us exercise it. It is an aspect of a class stratified society. And if we think we're living in a level playing field that's just defined by meritocracy or ever have, then I think we're fooling ourselves. But we would like to believe that that's the case. We have this core moral commitment to the idea of fairness and competitiveness and meritocracy. And we find abhorrent the idea of a stacked deck and when it leads to corruption, particularly political corruption that distorts the representative democratic process, then we're particularly outraged and rightly so. But I think some things are changing in a scary direction and other things are changing in a more positive direction.
Good.
If we look, for example, at one of the real crucibles of elite reproduction, the boarding schools of New England, which have been
prep
a mechanism
schools.
By which children have been filtered into powerful positions, probably 90 to 100% of those students 50 years ago went on to the proving grounds of Harvard and Princeton. Today, that's much less the case. It's still a huge advantage if you can find your way into those boarding schools. But you have to fight your way into those elite universities in competition with a lot of other people who didn't used to be there. So I think there's a way in which a more cultural commitment to meritocracy expressed through financial aid, through affirmative action, which has become an important part of the American landscape, has actually made things somewhat more democratic and open at the same time that we do see the concentration that Claire is talking about. It's just that we see it well beyond politics. Politics is just a special case of all the other cases that she cited in which parents are trying to advantage their children, and they always have, and they probably always will. What's key here, it seems to me, is whether or not what do those networks produce for people? Well, it produces insider information. It produces a thumb on the scale for opportunities. It's questionable to me whether or not it produces a liberty from credentialism, experience, or expectations for performance. I'm not so sure that that's the case. Yes, these kids have gotten their foot in the door where it would be much harder for other people, but they probably still have to prove themselves, except in extreme cases where, you know, something's gone truly awry. But for the most part, they are having to prove themselves.
Sooner or later, the rubber has to meet the road.
To do so.
Yeah, of course, it's all about the chance here. You say there's always been this element. Of course, there has parents try to help their children, but degree matters and perception matters, doesn't it?
I think perception really matters, especially in the political realm. That is, there's something we hold truly sacred about the distortion of representative democracy. I think we're a little bit less worried about or outraged by the reproduction of unequal power in the business world. It's always been there. We might throw a moral tantrum from time to time, but I think most of us realize that that's always been there. When it distorts the democratic process, then I think we really get worried that something very sacred is about to be destroyed through undue influence.
Claire Malone writes, even in the midst of an era of heightened awareness about inequality, both financial and social, we might well be experiencing the beginning of another historic cyclical upswing of powerful family bias. Let's go to our listeners. Nashville, John's calling. Hi, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on the show. My commentary is several things. Number one, to truly measure the nepotism, the study has to show where the opportunity lies for who. It's nobody's really debating, has there always been nepotism? That's truly understood, and there's truth in that. The comment just now that came about was that this idea of meritocracy, that's propagated by our media, that there's a chance for everybody. That, it's just false. And the last thing I have to say is that the piece that you're doing, and I thank you for your work, it's so soft, and I would suggest highly, if you brought on a man like Chris Hedges on your show, he would chew your guests apart.
You mean in the level of what acceptance of the dynamic you're saying, John?
The reality that we live in a different time than's ever been measured. I am a former history teacher out of Albion College, Michigan. I taught in South Central LA for 1 year. When you get down to people who are really struggling, this idea of meritocracy is just, it's such a false illusion for the reality of all Americans. And I can't believe we even have people who are educated. We live in an oligarchy. Washington is paid for by big money. God bless them. But to pretend that this is not the truth is just, it's illusional, as my...
Generally, we try and keep a pretty steady eye on it, and I hope you hear that, because it is, and it's a very, very important dynamic in this country right now. I mean, Catherine, there's the challenge, you know. The danger is just accepting that we move further and further away from even the ideal, from anything to do with the full reality of meritocracy here. And then you get John in Nashville saying, look, it's all-out oligarchy, and, you know, it just isn't working. I don't know what the next step after that is.
Well, let me just say, if it was all-out oligarchy, I don't think Bill Clinton would ever have become president. He might be spawning a dynasty now, but you can't really say that this, you know, son of a single mother from a pretty rough background was somehow
Hope.
The product of an oligarchy. I think the key point here is that we place high cultural value on meritocracy, even though it's never been completely true. It waxes and wanes in how untrue it is and in which sectors it's most pronouncedly untrue. But I do agree with the caller that it's a falsehood to think it's ever been a completely level playing field. It waxes, our economy and our opportunity structure waxes and wanes in how open it is to upward mobility.
I mean,
but
I don't think
Bill
Americans
Clinton
have
was
asked
not the
for.
Scion of
no, that's
elites.
True. You know, and I mean, I, no one asked for a completely level playing field. Americans are pretty lenient on that, but there's some sense of that there needs to be some degree of fairness or equity in opportunity, Claire. And, you know, the insinuation or the comment there is that we're just way past that now. That's not the reality we're living.
Well, I think, you know, in talking to some of these people that I spoke with about nepotism, I do think there's a certain amount of maybe a little bit of embarrassment about the opportunities that they've been given for sort of these more powerful children. I mean, there's the point that they all – there's, you know, ever since Occupy Wall Street, I think there has been a bit more talk generally across the board about structural inequality in this country. And I think that there are – in conversations when we talk about power and position, there's a lot more acknowledgement of, you know – white privilege, white male privilege, the privilege of money and education. And while that doesn't change the fact that certain people are getting certain jobs, I think the point that, you know, someone like – we still value that as Americans, that someone like Bill Clinton can come from Arkansas and become president. That doesn't change the fact that people from, you know, Choate and Andover are still going – boarding schools are still going to get hired for certain positions based on old ties.
I mean, take
but
Barack Obama for that matter. Not exactly
right.
Hope, Arkansas, but still – Anne in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air. What do you see, Anne?
Hi. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
You know, I think the worst of this, in my mind, is what the network stations do and these families, some of them the offspring of presidents and governors. For example, NBC hiring Jenna Bush and is it Abby Huntsman
John Huntsman's daughter. Mm-hmm.
Daughters of Republicans, so that they can put them on. You know, a lot of people see NBC as the left-leaning liberal network, but they hire these young people who are totally unqualified. They give them fluff pieces to do, or, you know, just something to make the
But, of course, it's not just Republicans. I mean, we all saw Chelsea Clinton up there, the Cuomos and Maria Shriver. I mean, she does good work.
I totally agree. ABC, they all do it. And, you know, the stations benefit because they get to have these other, you know, these other parties, perhaps, on their payroll and in the view of all their watchers. But then the families benefit because they have their names out there all the time. And, hey, look, our you know, daughters are on NBC, you know, they're not too...
Yeah, it works for everybody, but does it work, I mean, everybody in that golden circle, but what about beyond? I'm glad you raised it, Anne. One more while our time is there, Ishwar in Andover. Ishwar, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Up till now, you've been talking about the family and their names, kids and whatnot. What I have to ask is, when George W. Bush ran for president first time, even as if he lacked, of course, he lacked the credentials, said that he will make, if he wins the election, he will make Colin Powell the Secretary of State, which he did. But the funny part is, soon after that, Colin Powell's son was appointed FCC chair. And to add, whatever it is, as soon as Colin Powell left the place or the position, his son resigned the job or left the place and took on a lucrative job with, this cable TV people.
Yeah, families come and families go on up in that case. Ishwar, thanks for your call. Catherine Newman, how do we keep this in balance? You know, we don't want to turn into the thing that we don't imagine ourselves to be entirely. We want to have a break on this. How do you do that?
Well, I think there are two things. First, I think articles like Claire's are really important, and we need them to happen periodically so it reminds us where the playing fields are becoming particularly destabilized and unlevel. But the other aspect has to do with policies that are much broader than who gets into politics or who gets these incredibly lucrative jobs. If we pour money into a financial aid and make it possible for young people to go to college and break the tie between family poverty and a more middle-class future, we change that opportunity structure. If those boarding schools are now taking lots of kids from inner-city neighborhoods on scholarship, it changes who's in that pipeline. So there are policies and investments we can make that tilt the playing field back into something that's more level. And I think for us to focus entirely on these extremes and this tiny little group, powerful and important as it is, we can't lose sight of the much bigger dimensions of inequality that we can have an effect on through the investments we make in public institutions.
Well, hats off to everybody who does the work and shows the merit wherever they come from. Let's just try and keep the door wide open to all those who can and would do that. Catherine Newman, it's always great to have you here from Johns Hopkins
Thank you,
University.
Tom.
Great to have you here today. And Claire Malone, piece in Daily Beast is Get Elected, Get Your Kids Rich, Washington is Spoiled Rotten. Claire, thanks for your reporting and thank you for joining us right here today.
Thanks, Tom.
Great to have both of you with us. In a moment, we're going to look at the SAT's big announcement yesterday about a large overhaul there of the structure, format of the SAT. Talk about a door to opportunity that has been won for a long, long time. Stick with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Another facet of opportunity, a big overhaul announced yesterday for the SAT college admission test, back to a top score of 1,600. No more essay required, less emphasis on head-scratching vocabulary, and in an attempt to address the test's yawning income-based achievement gap, the College Board will team up with the Khan Academy to offer free online test prep. We'll look at the new format. You can join us. What do you think? Does this look like an improvement for the SAT? And what's your question on how it will work? Who it might help? Hurt? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Eric Hoover, senior writer for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Eric Hoover, welcome back to On Point. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
We'll look at what they're outlining, but just first, the big what's the big catalyst here? Why did the College Board move to make big changes in the SAT in the first place?
Well, it's a great question, and I think that over the last decade or so, since we were last talking about the overhaul that was coming to the SAT,
yeah.
I think there's a couple of things have happened. One is the ACT has really gained and gained on the SAT in terms of popularity. You used to see a regional breakdown between test takers who took the SAT and test takers who took the ACT.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the ACT has become much more of a national test over the last 10 years or so. So it's gained in popularity.
So there's competition for the SAT, but why would that lead them to change their test? What does that gain them?
Well, sure. And I think it's, I don't mean to say it's only about competition, but I think that the College Board, which is under new leadership, I think there's just been a vision change, if you will, with regard to what the test is telling colleges and high schools and students that's most important. And I think the overhaul speaks to a change in philosophy about what is most important, what the role of the test should be. Is it meant to trick students or at least put before them a riddle that they need to solve? Or is it aligned, is it more closely tethered to skills that they're hopefully honing in high school and that they will certainly need in college? I think the College Board looked at the test and decided that there was just a bit of a disconnect, or maybe in some areas of the test, a large disconnect between what was happening in high school and what colleges really wanted or needed.
And that the test was too much about tricks and riddles?
Well, I think that's definitely a knock on the SAT. And you heard some of this acknowledgement in David Coleman's remarks yesterday. He's the head of the College Board. And he said that on the new SAT, there would be no more mysteries. I think the SAT has long seemed mysterious, something that you had to game out and figure out. And certainly that'll still be true of the new test, but I think his wish, the way he describes his vision for the test, is that it will seem less like something to solve and more like something that allows you to display what you've learned, the skills you've learned, what you can put together on this exam.
I mean, doesn't that go to what it is? I mean, it's the SAT, the Scholastic Aptitude Test. Maybe that's where the mystery came in. It was an aptitude test, not a final exam on high school.
That's exactly right. And over the years, the name has changed. It was the Scholastic Aptitude Test, the Scholastic Assessment Test. Then it was just the SAT, kind of like KFC.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't really stand for anything. I think a helpful way to think of this is the SAT, if you can think of this car speeding through time, it's still the same car, I would say. Over the years, they've tweaked the engine. They've taken some things off the car. They put on a new whale tail. I think it's still the same car, essentially. It's not to say that some of these new features might not make a difference to students and colleges alike.
So there's the philosophical shift at work and maybe some of the competitive pressures there maybe as well. On the philosophical shift, take us through some of the specific changes and how they relate to what the SAT is trying to accomplish here.
I think one key word I would say is evidence. David Coleman, the head of the College Board, mentioned this several times yesterday in his remarks describing the new test. The new test will have a name change on a couple of the sections. It'll now be called evidence-based reading and writing, and that's no coincidence. In some cases, students will be asked to support answers that they choose on these tests, and they may be required, it sounds like they'll be required to cite a specific part of a reading passage that led them to choose that answer.
And there's always been reading and questions on the reading, so what exactly is the change?
Yeah, there's always been questions on reading and writing, but before you just had to pick an answer, and at least on some of the questions, as I understand it, you're going to have to show here's the right answer, I hope, and here's what led me to choose that answer.
I see, within the text.
Maybe taking out some of the possibility for just guessing, and I also think, you know, source documents sounds like it's something that's really important to the College Board. They want to bring in source documents that students can kind of get their hands dirty with, much like you see on the advanced placement exams where, you know, students have long worried about having to respond to document-based questions. You're not just pulling answers out. You're really forced to interact with a particular passage, a particular text, and hopefully make some sense of it, use your skills to make heads or tails of it.
Including the nation's founding documents, the Declaration of Independence, Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham Jail. These are going to be in there more.
Yes, in the Gettysburg Address. And I think that the idea there is, in the past and on the current exam, it's fair to say that many of the documents that students are going to, you know, see on a Saturday morning when they find themselves posed with questions relating to documents are drawn from texts that are just not widely available. They're obscure in many cases. In a sense, the content of them doesn't really matter as much. But if you're drawing from content for documents that really do matter, that certainly still matter in schools and that form conversations that many of us have our entire lives, talking about the Declaration of Independence or the Gettysburg Address or the I Have a Dream speech, these are texts, these are words that students are going to encounter over and over and over again. So
well, they sure will now. I can just imagine how much attention
yes,
there will be.
They will have extra incentive to ponder those the meaning of those texts.
Why no essay?
Well, I think the short answer is just a practical one. The essay, the addition of the essay on the current version of the exam, which debuted in 2005, it just was never a big hit. Some schools liked it, found it useful. I should say colleges found it useful. But I think for every one that did, in my experience, two or three others just didn't really care about it. They didn't want to look at those essays because they saw the essays that students wrote as being pretty far removed from the kind of work that students would have to do in college. And so for that reason, it just really wasn't worth the hassle to download them all and read through them. So therefore, why would the SAT continue to require something that many, many colleges just never really paid much attention to?
It sounds like less range in what students may be reading. You call it obscure. Okay. Also, though, less range in the math that they're required to show some mastery of.
Yeah, absolutely. And this I'm not sure if this would have been good or bad for a math challenge test taker like me, but as I understand it, in the current version of the SAT, you've got samples of content from all over the math map, a wide range of high school level math. There's one or two questions on each topic, and then the test moves on to the next one. It's trying to cover a wide area. And I think the new strategy is to cover less of a wide area, but to drill down deeper on a handful of topics, core math areas that students really need to have depth in. So algebra and some of the skills they'll need to hopefully go on and tackle calculus, which is something that I never could do.
What do you think? I mean, some years we hear about falling scores on the SAT. Is this, you know, does this net-net make the test easier so we feel better about ourselves? Or do you think it'll be just as rigorous as ever but with a different cast to it?
I think the latter is probably right. It's hard to say if a test. I mean, especially right now, we have some decent blueprints, but we haven't seen the items yet. Colleges are just beginning to get their heads around how these changes might affect them 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the line. So I don't think it'd be premature to say yes, the test will be easier. And even so, it's a hard thing to say. I think it'll still be that same car with different features, and some parts of it may be more challenging. I would say the essay, if a student happens to take it, is probably going to be a lot more challenging. You can't just get by now writing about your personal experience in whatever way you see fit. You have to respond to a document. Same is true for the evidence-based reading and writing sections, which will be mandatory. I think students are going to be asked to think a little harder about a text that's right in front of them, which is certainly something you are going to have to do in college.
Eric Hoover is with us with the Chronicle of Higher Education. We're looking at what the SAT is going to soon be. Eric, we've got questions, callers for you. Amanda in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina. Amanda, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you think about the new announcement?
Well, I'm a high school teacher in a real low-income area.
Okay.
And most of my students, even the very high-achieving ones, they score extremely low on the ACT and the SAT. Even the students who are impressive across the board. And so there's a clear, I would call it an income disparity to achievement on the standardized test. And so I think this is a really good change, especially the coupling with Khan Academy, just because it doesn't seem fair to the students who are really working hard and still scoring extremely low.
And Amanda, what is it in what's been announced? You're a high school teacher, low-income area. What is it in what you heard yesterday that makes you feel this will work better for your students in that environment?
I think that the change from obscure vocabulary words to real academic vocabulary words will be a huge help to these students, because we use words like that, like and evidence-based thinking in our classes all the time. So that's skills that they're familiar with. Additionally, this test is, it seems to be aligned with a common core, which most states are adopting. So it's more showing what students are learning rather than have I memorized Greek roots for words.
It's true that the College Board Chief David Coleman came out of that Common Core. He's one of the architects of that. Amanda, stand by. Eric Hoover, what about it? There's been a long-time criticism of the SAT that there was a kind of cultural bias in it. Is Amanda right that this may take some of that out and make it more accessible to her students in a low-income area there in North Carolina?
I think she mentioned two reasons why that might be so, or at least why people have reasonable hope that it is so. And I think the vocabulary word change, for one thing, may just serve to some degree David Coleman's wish to make the SAT more accessible. If you're not having to wade through these words that really no one outside of certain levels of higher ed use, well, then you're using words that you actually need to carry with you through life. And I think also the test prep partnership with the Khan Academy. I think people are cautiously optimistic about the potential of that to level the playing field to some degree. I think one caution there, though, is if a student simply doesn't have a basics in a given topic, a given academic field, all the test prep in the world, no matter how well done it is, no matter how thorough it is, it's not really going to help that student too much, especially if that student lacks a wise elder, let's call him or her, a teacher, a parent, a mentor, a college counselor, to help along the way, then I think the test prep part of the equation doesn't look as rosy. That's not the College Board's fault. I think many people applaud that change, but I do think we could easily get carried away in thinking about what free test prep videos and whatever else is involved might do for most low-income students who need a lot more than test prep.
Certainly the head of the College Board that puts out the SAT spoke to that at his news conference. This was in Austin, Texas yesterday. Said changes being made to the SAT to address inequalities are being made to address inequalities made worse by expensive testing fees and prep courses.
While it may not be our fault, it is our problem. Because if these numbers do not change, we shall build an iron wall of inequality into the next generation.
So the SAT chief, College Board chief, they're putting him on, trying to put himself on the right side of, I don't know, history, class and opportunity politics, maybe realities. Carol in New Orleans is calling. Hi, Carol, you're on the air.
My comment is simply this. If the articles that you read in the New York Times will be similar to what a kid will see in the SAT, then it's achieved a great purpose. Because even some of the smartest students in the city of New Orleans will tell you that the SAT is actually horrible. And there's nothing that can connect with the articles that they have to read, even though they, you know, they fight their way through it and they do well. But if you read the New York Times, that's a pretty heady newspaper. You know, any kid who can read that and read a normal textbook and derive meaning from that ought to do well on the SAT when they change it, because the mathematics section sometimes is too broad, and you can do maybe 20 problems and see if a kid's on level for college-level math, as opposed to doing 2 hours of one subject and 2 hours, you know, a four-hour test is a bit ridiculous.
If you can read the Times and define everything that's in there, you should be in pretty good shape, Carol's saying. But Eric, didn't they use some of that kind of crazy vocabulary, the really obscure words? I mean, after all, you're trying to create a range of scores here, and you don't want everybody to score right up at the top. Weren't they using those in part to decide, well, who gets, I don't know, a 780, a 790, an 800?
Sure. I mean, I guess you don't want everyone to get the same score. I don't think that's in any danger of happening, no matter how the test was changed. Certainly, through its history, those kinds of words in particular were infamous, as I've always understood it, for weeding out students who had a certain kind of cultural experience and those who had not. But again, that's just one piece of the test. And I think we're still going to see a wide range of scores, and we're still going to see them break down by income, no matter what vocabulary words the College Board chooses to put on the test.
So here we go, and it's back to 1600, and meanwhile, lots of colleges thinking about whether they even want to use these tests and outcomes anymore. What's the trend on that, Eric?
Well, I think you're seeing still over the years a steady drop in the schools that require the ACT or SAT. However, and you know, many people will say this, and they want to look at the world this way. They'll say, but the nation's most selective / prestigious famous institutions continue to require those exams, and I think, by and large, that will remain true. I do think uncertainty about this test might make colleges consider whether or not they want to continue requiring the ACT or SAT. Don't know whether that'll be a giant trend, but I think for many colleges that aren't the most famous institutions, that aren't the 25 most selective colleges, there is an ongoing conversation. Do we want to continue to require any of these tests? And how would that help us, or how might it hurt us? I think those conversations are ongoing, and I think this will maybe jolt some energy into what might be a long, winding conversation about this. You never know.
Yeah,
colleges that are test optional might require the tests again, as I've heard from a few people, depending on what it tells them.
A recalibration coming up here in a couple years in the format of the SAT. Eric Hooper is senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education, joined us from Washington. Eric, always good to talk with you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by Emily Alphen Johnson, Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, James Ross, and Dean Russell. With help from Claire Lancaster and Sarah Platt, our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.